Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, joining you after the New Year holidays, and I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Melissa Bromley. Today, we're gearing up for the Governor's State of the State with two interviews. The first is with Peter Lavinia, one of New York State co-chairs for the Green Party.
We'll also have an interview with Devin Reinbach, a local hypnotist, as part of our spirituality series.
We also have a discussion with Rensselaer County Democratic Minority Leader Peter Grimm.
And we're going to finish up back to that State of the State with Blair Horner, Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group.
Nyberg,
yes.
One of the men accused of carrying out the brutal slayings of two women and two children in Troy was banned from the city mission in Schenectady because of violent outbursts. The shelter's director confirmed this on Monday. James White was banished several months ago after allegations that he fought with others in the shelter. The Troy police arrested James White along with Justin Mann for first and second degree murder for the quadruple homicide that took place in Troy on the night of December 21st. There is a GoFundMe page for those looking to support the family.
Jennifer Pallaro, a one-time top aide to former state assembly member Steve McLaughlin, alleges that he pressured her to retract her accusation that he had roughed her up during a heated argument at his residence in August, according to the Times Union. McLaughlin took office on Monday as Rensselaer County executive. Pallaro's disclosure comes as the State Assembly Ethics and Guidance Committee is reviewing a complaint about McLaughlin's treatment of Pallaro, including his use of vulgar language in apparent violation of the legislature's harassment policy. The State Assembly had previously sanctioned McLaughlin for another sexual harassment incident when he asked a female assembly staff person for nude photos.
The state minimum wage in the Capital District increased on January 1st from $9.70 an hour to $10.40. In downstate areas, the minimum wage now ranges from $11 per hour to $13 per hour.
Last Friday, the Troy City Council finally approved this budget, which included a $160 per unit garbage fee instead of a 15% tax hike in property taxes. The fee will sunset at the end of 2018. The city may then replace it with a system of charges based on the volume of garbage residents throw out. Officials hope to improve the city's recycling program, which only recycles 6% of the city's waste.
After busting the federal budget with massive tax giveaways to the wealthy, Republicans in Congress are now decrying deficits and excessive federal spending in order to force cuts in human service programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, housing, and food stamps. However, the GOP is also pushing for a massive hike in spending in the already massive military budget. Democrats are pushing for more spending on programs that support education, scientific research, infrastructure, public health, and environmental protection. Republicans will also tie immigration to the looming federal budget fight.
Renee Witherspoon, Meryl Streep, Shonda Rhimes, and more than 300 other women are taking a stand against sexual harassment and assault in the entertainment industry by launching Time Up, a movement that aims to promote equality and safety in the workplace. The initiative addresses legislation, corporate policy, and hiring practices. One of its initiatives is a legal defense fund to help individuals who've experienced sexual misconduct obtain legal representation.
Thanks, Mark. Just want to jump in there and say it's Reese Witherspoon, and the group's name is Time's Up. Very excited about this.
And that was it for headlines. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, you can visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
As we mentioned earlier, this Wednesday is the governor's annual State of the State address. We are going to start off with an interview from Peter Lavinia, co-chair of the Green Party of New York, about their key legislative issues for 2018 in New York State. This is Mark Dunley, and we're talking with Peter Lavigne, who's one of the state co-chairs of the Green Party of New York State. And Peter, we're about to see the annual State of the State address by the governor. What are some of the key issues that the Green Party is looking at here in New York State in 2018?
We have four key issues that we've identified as legislative priorities in 2018. The first, and probably familiar to your listeners, is single-payer health care. Many of you may know that there is a bill, the New York Health Act, that is about one senator short of passing. Governor Cuomo has said that he would sign it if it came to his desk. And we're looking to push that as one of our main priorities. Also, a ban on single-use plastic bags. We're looking to make sure that we have a statewide ban. Last year, Greens pushed for a ban in New York City, which unfortunately the legislature and the governor spiked. The Greens have come around and said, well, if you're not going to allow it to happen in New York City, let's do it across New York State. Let's get in front of it. These are, you know, major problems in terms of waste, and New York State can become a leader in banning plastic bags. Also, mass transit. This is something that I think New Yorkers are familiar hearing about, and the deterioration of the subways. This is going to be a major issue in 2018. New York City subways need a massive amount of capital to rebuild. I mean, the governor and the legislature have been using the MTA as a piggy bank for years, have stripped it of much of its funding, and we're seeing the results now. And what's interesting to us is that mass transit and mass transit funding, both in New York City and the rest of New York City, which we'd like to see expanded, is a way that we can combat climate change. That's the fourth of our issues. We'd like to see an immediate attempt to move towards a carbon-free economy in New York State, to solarize, to make sure that we move towards renewable energy, something we can do in the next 10 to 15 years. It absolutely has to be done. So those are our four main issues, and we hope to be pursuing them in the legislature in 2018, both by, you know, talking to legislative officials and also out in the streets, talking to everyday voters, talking to people who want to come to Albany and also in their local communities to protest and to say, you know, we need to move on these issues to make New York a better and greener place.
Now, right now, the state is facing somewhere in the order of about a $4 billion annual deficit. Governor Cuomo, of course, has always says he's opposed tax increases, and even the Assembly Speaker said that if the federal tax cuts went through at the federal level and we lost the ability for rich people to deduct their income taxes in New York, that he would oppose any increase to tax the wealthy because he doesn't want them to flee to Texas or someplace. How would New York Green Party go about trying to raise revenues here in the state? Or would you just support cutting services across the board?
I think that the first thing that we would do is, and we have been doing this for a number of years, is talk about not rebating the stock transfer tax. This is a financial transactions tax. It's been on the books for nearly a century, I think over a century at this point. And ever since Mario Cuomo, we've simply given back the percentage tax that we take on each stock purchase to the purchaser. A number of years ago, the Fiscal Policy Institute here in Albany said that we could raise probably between $5 and $8 billion a year. That study was done between 5 and 10 years ago. Who knows what it would be now? I think that would be one way to close the budget deficit. Another way would be to restore progressive income taxation in New York State. We have a very slightly progressive income tax here in New York State at this point. We would like to see a return to the 70s bracketing system where we could have 12, 13, 14 brackets where the wealthy, the very top 1%, where most of the wealth is accrued, pay the majority of taxes and the rest of us get a tax break, which is certainly not the case in New York State with its relatively flat structure right now. And especially after what's happening in Congress right now. We're not going to see at the national level. And I'd like to add that there are studies, multiple studies, that show that taxing the wealthy does not make them move. In fact, over and over again, scholars have shown that if you raise taxes, it raises revenues, and the wealthy stay put even if they claim that they're going to move. So I think this is something that the governor is either misinformed about or is not telling the truth on.
Now, in the Capital District, we have the Upper Hudson Green Party, which covers a number of the counties throughout the area, Warren, Saratoga, Schenectady, Albany, and Rensselaer. What are some of the plans that the Green Party has locally in 2018?
Well, I think number one, we'd like to run candidates for state and federal races. There are a number of assembly and state senate races, and we'd like to get out there both finding people who want to run as Greens and also supporting people who will announce hopefully in the next couple months. And we'd also like to support our gubernatorial candidate next year. 2018 is a gubernatorial year. That's where we can maintain our ballot status. We need 50,000 votes as a party for a gubernatorial candidate. The last few cycles, we've had Howie Hawkins run, and he's both got us ballot status in 2010 with about 70,000 votes, and then he got over 100,000, I think over 150,000 votes in 2014, and we're now row D. We'd like to do better. We'd like to be row A, B, or C. So, that's going to, I think, take up a lot of 2018 here locally, besides expanding, our issues-based campaigns based on what's going on in the Capital District and what's going on at the state level.
Now, following Bernie Sanders' campaign, and to a certain extent, certainly Jill Stein as well, there does seem to be an upsurge of support, especially among young voters, for the concept of socialism. Mm-hmm. And I know that's something that the Green Party has grappled with, whether it's an anti-capitalist party or not. So some of those young people out there looking for a socialist alternative, how does the Green Party meet their needs?
Well, I'd like to say that I'm one of the founders of the Green Socialist Caucus, something that we have here locally and are looking to expand across New York State and hopefully to the rest of the National Green Party. What I'd like to say is this: the Greens are a broad party. We're not explicitly socialist, but we welcome socialists. We welcome people who want to think beyond capitalism. At the national level last year, we added a platform plank on economic democracy. That was something many of us here in New York State were in favor of, us, those of us who are either supporters of socialism or sympathetic. So I think that the important point is that the Green Party is a place where you can run as a socialist. We invited Bernie to run last year on a green line. Many of our platform points are in line with what people who support socialism, I think believe, things like single-payer health care, living wage jobs, ending the wars abroad and American militarism. I mean, these are things that we can talk about as Greens, and then there's a space for them, even if the Greens aren't explicitly a socialist party.
So if people want to get more active in the Green Party, how can they do so? And, what's sort of the Green reaction to the first year or so of the Trump administration? Has he been as bad as you had thought he would be?
I think Trump has been as bad, if not worse. I think that what's going on with the Trump administration is that there is an outward appearance of chaos. I mean, and obviously Trump says things that, don't exactly help what he wants to do, which is uniformly terrible. but behind the scenes, he's dismantling many of the regulations and protections that we have, the safeguards that we have based on, environmental protections, worker safety, and those regulations. And then in terms of foreign policy, Donald Trump is pursuing, I think, openly what other presidents have pursued covertly, which is this imperialist foreign policy. So we're seeing this warlike kind of bellicosity from him that only happened behind the scenes with Obama, who would come out and say very nice things and then, bomb countries. So I think that, Trump has been on the whole terrible. And I think moving forward that we have to unite as a left and say, you know, we're not going to allow this to happen. We're going to elect independent left candidates to office. We're going to protest in the streets. We're not going to allow, you know, corporate Dems or corporate candidates to buy off the movement. And in terms of how people can get involved locally, if they're interested in that, you can find us online at Facebook at Upper Hudson Green Party. We have a website, and you can find us through the State Green Party, State Green Party's website right now, which is gpny.org. And our next meeting will be on the third Tuesday in January at 6:45 p.m. in the main branch of the Albany Public Library on Washington Avenue.
And that was Peter Lavigne of the Green Party of New York, and this has been Mark Dunley for WOOC. And as I just noted, that was Peter Lavigne discussing the Green Party's state agenda for 2018, and I should disclose that I'm a member of the Green Party.
Now we turn to WOOC correspondent Des Moines George, who sat down with Devin Reinbach, a hypnotist new to the Troy area, to discuss spirituality.
Tell us about yourself.
Hi, Des Moines. My name is Devin Reinbach. I'm a hypnotist, in the state of New York, I'm allowed to call myself a hypnosis practitioner.
Excellent.
Technically, not allowed to call myself a hypnotherapist, but I do use hypnosis therapeutically. There's a lot of legal jargon that has to be thought about there.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of legal jargon going into the wellness practitioner area, from trying to force people to have licensures where there exists none, to, I know last week when we talked to Andrew at Heartspace Yoga, to some studios that, you know, just pop up because that's what people need, mm-hmm. which is really like the basis of wellness. There's a need for spirituality and wellness to be practiced, and people at least have the right to practice. Mm-hmm. So, tell me about your practice. Where did you learn?
So, I learned at a school called the Hypnotherapy Academy of America. That's in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I started school last January, so just about a year ago. And I finished in April. It's a 400-hour program. And it's a pretty cool school because what they're trying to do is make hypnotherapy more accepted as a medical adjunctive treatment. So their goal is to work cooperatively with mental health practitioners and medical health practitioners instead of trying to be in competition. Their program is much longer than most schools. I mean, one of the, kind of going back to what we were just talking about, hypnotherapy is not federally regulated, so you can't get a license for it. However, you can get certified by any one of hundreds of private certifying bodies. And most of them, you know, you can just go take a 25-hour online course without ever meeting anyone face-to-face, and essentially you're paying for a piece of paper that says you're certified. Or you can go for like an intensive program and actually learn how to do things the right way. What it really comes down to, though, is just building rapport with people, because, you know, it's really hard in this society if you have a knack for helping people in any way therapeutically, there are so many walls that you have to climb to just do that. And, I mean, I have to be careful about what exactly I do with people, because, you know, if we have too long of a conversation, I might have to worry about practicing psychotherapy without a license. Unless, of course, I call myself a life coach or a mind coach or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I was looking at the statutes in New York State, and they actually have some pretty ambiguous language. Like, if you do something that somebody thinks a psychologist does, then you're practicing psychology, and that's against the law.
Right.
Which I feel like is very interesting, because on most parts, people don't really know the exact in-depth day-to-day work of a psychologist. Mm-hmm. So many people's idea of psychologists is they sit with you and they talk to you about your problems. Mm-hmm. And so now you run into the issue of, hey, he's sitting with me talking to me about my problems. Yeah, it can get weird in the wellness industry here. So what brought you to hypnotherapy?
Hypnosis has been an interest of mine since I was a kid. I remember getting a few books on it as Christmas presents, for example. And then I would try to hypnotize my sister and my parents, and nobody was buying it. So I remember back then I used to have a very different conception of hypnosis than I do today, after actually having studied it. I thought it was some kind of like special power, and you can like, well, you now are a duck, and you will quack like a duck and walk and waddle like a duck. It doesn't really work like that. And a little over a year ago, I started a Master of Social Work degree. And a few weeks into it, I realized it just wasn't the methodology that I wanted to use to help people, because I didn't really want to learn about how to navigate the system. I want to just directly help people with their problems right now, right here. You come see me for like an hour. You walk out of here, like a huge step toward your goals. There doesn't have to be all of this paperwork and all this stuff and all this, well, you know, you're going to have to come back to see me for like, you know, once a week for 2 years, and then maybe we'll make some headway on the childhood trauma. And it's like, no, you can fix this like very quickly if you have the desire to change. Like, if you want to change something, you really want it, I can help you do that. Because, you know, sometimes it's just like flicking a switch or helping someone see something a different way that they'd never thought about before. And basically, my skill set helps people to be their own therapists. It's an empowering thing. I show people how powerful they really are.
And hypnosis isn't a very new field. It's definitely been practiced for a very, very long time. I know you talked about, you know, wanting to change in people's ideas about changing. You know, we just started a new year. And you have a lot of people now talking about, you know, what their New Year's resolutions are, or the things that they want to change about themselves in the new year. What would you have to say for anybody? They're already struggling keeping up that New Year's resolution.
I would say slow down and take some time, give yourself some time to fully accept where you are right now. Just no matter what you're trying to change about maybe your body or your lifestyle, just accept where you are. Because acceptance is the gateway to transformation. You have to realize where you are right now before you can understand where you want to go. And, you know, there's no sense in running away from things. Because wherever you are, there you are. You can't run away from these things. You just got to accept them and say, all right, this is how things are. This is how I want them to be. Now let me maybe build a plan. Maybe I'll just pause, take a break, and sit in silence and just like listen to what's going on inside, because, you know, a lot of people are very caught up with what's happening out here. We forget to actually look inside. We forget there's a world in here. So that's my recommendation.
Yeah, it's a whole universe in there, actually. Yeah. And so if somebody wanted to get in contact with you to either talk about your services or just maybe hear more from you on these topics, how would they get in contact with you?
So they can go to my website, which is dr-hypnosis.com. All my contact info is there. I'm also on Facebook if you look for d.r.hypnosis. There isn't much on the Facebook page yet. I'm sure it'll be populated in the near future. And I look really forward to speaking with you soon.
That was Des Moines George with Devin Reinbach, a hypnotist new to the Troy area. As he mentioned, you can get in contact with Devin by visiting his website at dr-hypnosis.com. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Melissa Bromley.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, you can check us out at mediasanctuary.org. Next on our show is Professor Ildefonso Aplans, interviewing Democrat Minority Leader Peter Grimm. Grimm is a legislator for Rensselaer County, representing District 1. He's part of the Budget and Finance Committee and the Rules, as well as the Legislative Committee. This portion of this interview focuses on his reelection and the politics of Rensselaer County.
So I want to welcome Mr. Peter Grimm here to our segment. We're going to be talking to him about politics here in Rensselaer County. He is the legislator for District 1 here in Troy and has been reelected already for the next term. So, Mr. Grimm, thank you so much for having us here in your office today. I would like to thank you, obviously, for that. And why don't we begin by reflecting on, it's almost December, the end of the year. Reflect a little bit on this past term that you have, that you're finishing now, and thinking about what's ahead in the future of your district.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you. The you know, reflection on the past term, and the term is 4 years. You know, I'm pretty happy with the accomplishments that we have made. I don't know, a little background of me, of course, is that I'm the minority leader for the legislature. I sit in the minority caucus, which is six of the 19 legislators in Rensselaer County. Yeah. And in fact, the six Democrats are also the six District 1, and the other 13 are Republican. So it's been an interesting term for us. I mean, as the minority, I think the most important thing is that, you know, people understand that, you know, we have a voice at the table. It often can be in the sense of a watchdog or the other side. And, you know, we don't have any voting power because we're the minority, yeah. And the majority has a super majority. But that said, I think we have worked very partisanly with the other side in this past term. Some things we can be very proud of that I can reflect back on, of course, are you know, good solid budgets, mm-hmm. over the past 4 years. You know, we've managed to come in under the state mandated tax cap, which we're all proud of, and the work that's done in the county by the, you know, the department heads. And I think it's also...
let me add, that you are part of the committee, the Budget and Finance Committee, if I understand.
I am.
Very interesting.
Yeah, and that's the structure of the committees. That is that, you know, we have someone from the minority office sits on budget and rules as well as the majority. And that's where all of the, you know, our fiduciary resolutions come through after they've gone through their own independent committees. Mm-hmm. So, but to track back a little bit, you know, the budget is something that we're very proud of. We've worked bipartisanly with the other side on that. And then also, I think it's, you know, the things that we've been, you know, proud of the accomplishments of the legislature in an overall sense is, you know, services in Rensselaer County, I'm sure you know that they're mandated, most of them, by the state. Mm-hmm. You know, the state funds quite a few of them. But, you know, the execution of them, I think, is important. And, you know, our oversight on what the departments do here is essentially what, you know, is part of the success of these programs. Yeah. I think we have good, strong, successful programs. I think they hold tight to a budget. I think we also have done some great initiatives in the past 4 years. We've done some shared services. We also have, you know, a focus on green. We've done some, you know, great solar kind of energy building within in the county. We get power for county buildings from solar farms, you know, and have worked out situations like that. You know, we've also been very involved in, you know, supporting communities that are working for green initiatives or, you know, important ecology matters. For instance, the pipeline that was going in southeastern Rensselaer County last year was, you know, a very big issue, and the county got behind the residents of that area and stood firm with them on that. Going forward, I would like to see, you know, the same kind of work being done, to see the same accomplishments. You know, to the people of Rensselaer County, the services and the taxes are probably their two largest concerns. Yeah. I mean, there are the people that, you know, use the services, and then there's also the taxpayer that pays the taxes. So, I mean, our focus always needs to be on those two things. And at the same time, I think we all bring to the table our concerns with, you know, quality of life issues and, you know, economic development and green issues and initiatives. So we look forward to continuing the fine work we've done.
So it is, even though it has some challenges for you guys to rule, to be able to be in the table where you're not the majority, what it seems is that there's a work together, a teamwork in between both parties that allows the county as a whole to continue to provide services to our communities.
Well, yes, that's so. The you know, compromise is often in the middle of the road.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You know? We don't drive the bus, though, to get us there sometimes. And I think on critical issues, and the issues that where it comes to, you know, the budget, and it comes to services and maintaining and keeping the services at the level that they need to be, I believe that we have a good working relationship in a very, you know, bipartisan kind of relationship with.
Now, another question that I have is, this county has primarily Troy as the major city, then you have Rensselaer, and then the rest of the county is primarily a rural county.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that is fascinating about these dynamics is that most of the Democrats are all in the city, if I am correct. So how do you guys coincide the issues that pertain to the city, which represent the residents that voted for you, with the issues that relate to the county in relation to the rural communities?
Well, I think that's historical. I think historically that, you know, the cities tend to be, you know, lean more Democratic, and the hill towns have been Republican. You know, the interesting part of what we deal with on the county level is, you know, we deal with the issues of the county even though we represent the city.
Yes.
We vote. We impact everyone that lives in the county. You know, cities have city services. They have their own services. You know, they have their own police protection. They have their own garbage. They have their own, maintain their own streets, where the county, you know, we have the highway department.
Yeah.
We have, you know, the county is county services.
Yeah.
And we have that, you know, that's what we govern over, are the county services. And, you know, then there are city services.
Yes.
That don't, those services don't pertain to the hill towns.
Okay? Yes.
And often, you know, some constituents think that we have control over the city issues, but there's another form of government, there's city government,
yes,
that handles those. As in the towns, there are, you know, the village and towns have their own government structure, but it's not as broad as the city structure. And then, you know, in some cases, you know, we have a different demographic in the city. The city is where all the services are kind of central. So,
yes,
therefore, we have, our constituents are probably more of people that use the services than in the hill towns, percentage-wise.
I mean,
so it gives us a different demographic, I think, but we still approach it with the understanding of how important the services are. And I think that the Hilltown representatives understand that as well.
Okay.
So I don't see a lot of conflict when,
okay,
it comes to real county business.
Good. Now, moving into national politics and linking that to the local politics, how do you see this tax new bill is going to impact? There's a lot of talk about paying taxes at the local level, not being able to write them off. There's a lot of talk about whether or not you're going to be able to itemize and how much you're going to be able to itemize. So what do you see as this bill comes to a good shape? I mean, the bill is not well there yet, mm-hmm, but the talks are. So I was just wondering if you have any say on that, if you would like to share that with us.
Well, you know, everyone's talking about the tax bill. And I think, you know, and, you know, there's all kinds of slants and bents on this, depending on where you're getting your information from.
Absolutely.
And people take stands on certain sides of this. You know, from my understanding, you know, the corporate relief, you know, the interpretation of that is that is supposed to help in a broad stroke the whole economy.
Yes.
Well, we can hope, but we don't know. But we do know that the percentage of people that will get the most in, you know, reduction with filing seem to be an upper middle class to higher demographic.
Yes.
The people that we think it will hurt the most are the poor people.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that's something to consider. You know, it favors some and not others. I don't know all the details of the bill, you know, at this point.
Yeah.
But what I
don't know that anyone knows all the details.
Exactly. I think it's very difficult. But, you know, I don't think it's fair for everyone. So, and, you know, am I against the conversation? No, I'm not against the conversation. But am I not for it as I see it right now? I'm not.
Okay. And what is the what do you sense from the Republican Party in terms of the members of the chamber? What are their, one can say that if you're a partisan, then you will be supporting the bill, mm-hmm, regardless. But I'm sure that there's got to be some reservations also as to how this is going to impact each district here in our county, not to mention at the state more broadly. So what is the sense that the chamber has overall about this bill that you can fill out?
I have nothing to report on that. We haven't had that conversation.
Oh, okay.
Besides, you know, and will we? I don't know. I mean, I don't see. We haven't brought to the table any urging or anything. This is federal government.
Yes,
you
absolutely.
Know? And we've been wrapped up with our own budget right now, you know, which was just passed this month.
Yes.
We're at year end here, doing a lot of housekeeping and getting things done as well. We often don't caucus with the majority. So therefore, we don't have a lot of conversation.
Okay.
About, you know, things broader than what's at hand in the county or county issues. And I think that's just the nature of the structure. Would it be nice if we did? Yeah, it would be. But we don't.
Okay. Anyway, I don't want to take more time of your agenda. I appreciate that you have given us this opportunity to talk to us. I hope that this is not the first time, that we have other interviews ahead. And thank you so much for your time, Mr.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Ildefonso Aplins interviewing Peter Grimm, Rensselaer County Legislator for District 1 in Troy.
So now we're going to go back to the State of the State, which is taking place tomorrow. And we're going to interview Blair Horner of the New York Public Interest Research Group. And I should disclose I was the co-founder of NYPIRG back in 1973 and doing some contract work for them right now on climate change. And we're going to discuss with Blair about what issues NYPIRG hopes the legislature and the governor would deal with in 2018. We're talking with Blair Horner, executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group. Blair, at the upcoming Governor's State of the State address, what are some of the issues that NYPIRG hopes that the governor will be addressing?
Well, when we look at the session, we see basically four shadows over the session. One is the state is facing a multi-billion-dollar deficit. The other is the implications of the federal tax reform and what impact it's going to have on the state budget. For example, the changes to the Affordable Care Act. There'll be obviously a re-election. All the governor and all the legislators will be up for re-election. So that's a third shadow. And the fourth is every month for the first 6 months of 2018, a new corruption trial of a high-ranking state official will begin. And so when you look at the session, those things, I think, are going to be the four issues that's going to drive what's ultimately going to happen. And so things that cost money are going to be harder to get done. Things that are reacting to efforts to battle corruption, I think, are going to be taken more seriously. There's a number of issues where we think there's opportunities for good things to happen, but it's all going to be done within the context of the four shadows that I described earlier.
Well, one of the issues that NYPIRG, being a student-led organization, has always worked on has been the issue of funding for higher education. You know, how are the state's universities doing at this point? And, you know, what are some of the things that you're hoping to see? And I guess some of the students may also be concerned about tuition issues.
Right. I mean, last year when the governor did his Excelsior Scholarship Program, which was to provide financial aid for families of students going to public college, and their incomes were under $100,000, the governor said that they would guarantee the state would make sure they went for free, came with a lot of caveats. You had to be full-time, you had to take a certain number of credits, you had to perform at a certain level within the school. And the governor coupled that with a tuition hike for everyone. And so the state has argued that they will maintain their support for the public colleges even though there's a tuition hike. What's in reality happening is the state's not maintaining its support at levels to cover inflation and other costs. And so those tuition hikes are basically, we believe, covering budget shortfalls. The governor had a proposal just before him this week to fix that. He vetoed the bill last night. And so we think that the state higher education systems are going to be looking at more reductions in state support that's going to be offset by money coming out of college students' pockets, despite the fact that the governor has promised that students will be going to school, going to public college for free. That covers 20-some-odd thousand students. We'll be pushing for an expansion of that program to make sure more students get involved and that the state is providing the necessary support for the colleges.
Now, when you talk about corruption, you know, that seems to be something that every governor, when they run for office, promises to fix. And yet year after year goes by and little seems to happen, and the number of state legislators going to jail or being forced to leave office continues to increase. Okay, so we're going to have a couple of high-profile trials this year. How do you think that's going to actually result in some ethics reform being passed? How far is this governor going to push it, and what are some of the changes that are really needed?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, 2 years ago, you would have thought that the indictment and conviction of the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker of the Assembly would tip the scales. It was Albany's Watergate moment, and it turned out to be Albany's kick the can moment. And they all got away with it. They basically did nothing of consequence. They ran for re-election in 2016, and all of them, virtually all, one legislator lost on the issue of corruption. They all got reelected, and so they feel like they're impervious to the issue. Now, Governor Cuomo, when he ran in 2010, said he was going to clean up Albany. He was going to be the guy who would finally slay the corruption dragon. And if anything, I think it's fair to say, if anything, he has not fulfilled that promise. I think that's a fairest way to describe it. And if the governor has his he's up for re-election in 2018, it's a way for the public to review his record. There will be new corruption cases coming up every single month for the first 6 months of 2018. Every month there's a new case. And so there'll be a lot of pressure, a lot of discussion on the issue. And if the governor has his eyes on higher office to be the governor of what is considered by some to be one of the most corrupt states in the country, that's not going to help. So we think it's up to the governor to use his time to advance proposals that finally deal with this problem.
You mentioned one of the concerns going on right now with the federal budget is the, I guess, real likelihood with the tax cuts that the Affordable Care Act is going to be undermined. What do you see as some of the critical health care issues that the governor needs to address?
Well, you know, we're still sort of dealing with figuring out how this is all going to be done. The things we know for sure is that the child health insurance program expires on January 1st. That could change between now and then.
And that's a federal program.
That's right. That's a federal law. And so it's the federal support for the program. In the tax reform proposal, they eliminate the mandate that people have to have health insurance. And so that's going to have an effect because it's effectively people that don't need health insurance will be the people most likely now to pull out because there'll be no penalty. And so what impact that's going to have? The state is running its own health exchange and the state is running its own programs. And so how much that affects the state is unclear, but it's going to cost the state more if they want to maintain the amount of coverage that exists for kids and for people who heretofore were uninsured but are now part of the New York's health exchange. So how that's all going to play out is unclear, but it's going to cost the state more money is a fair guess, unless the state decides it's going to roll back protections and coverage, which I think is unlikely to be the case in an election year.
Now, the state is facing some estimate of a $4 billion deficit going into next year, some say higher. Obviously, this governor has been very opposed to the concept of tax hikes, and even the Assembly Speaker, Carl Hastie, said earlier that if the federal tax system went through, that eliminated the personal income and property tax deduction for high-income taxpayers, that he was not inclined to increase the taxes on the wealthy. So how do you, what are some of the options and how do you deal with this $4 billion deficit, which may be increased based on what we do with health care?
I mean, that's a very good question. And I think the political climate for raising taxes is going to be already very difficult to do, is going to be even that much more difficult. I mean, it's being an election year, of course, the muscle memory of policymakers will be to try to figure out some way to sort of paper it over and kick the can and deal with it next year. That would be sort of the muscle memory way of dealing with it. I mean, the state has a $160 billion budget. That's a lot of money. There's a lot of ways that even if you had a $4 billion deficit or a $5 billion deficit, there may be ways to sort of kick the can on some the way you pay out the bills. To me, one place to look will be, are the state's tax expenditures in terms of incentives to businesses to be to act in a way that increases the state's economic climate and creates more jobs, are those programs working or is that just money out the door? And so I think that while tax rates may be much more difficult to go up, it may be an opportunity to examine the state's economic development programs, its tax expenditure programs, to see if the state is getting its money's worth out of those, and that may provide some additional revenues there.
I will note that I understand that Senator Krueger is introducing a bill to look at perhaps $1 billion, I'm not sure the exact amount, but in fossil fuel tax expenditures. We'll get a couple minutes left here. Campaign finance reform, is that just a pipe dream?
Well, interesting. Suffolk County just approved it today, a system of public financing modeled more or less on the New York City model. And the New York City model is a public financing system that is viewed by many as a model for the country. So in the area of campaign finance reform, advocates are limited in what they can really achieve because of Supreme Court decisions that make it really difficult to do that. You can create a voluntary system of public financing, which encourages candidates to run who ordinarily would not be able to, and encourages the vast majority of the public to participate, because otherwise you have a dialing for dollar system. Public financing encourages public matches for small donations. So that means you got to go out and talk to real people as compared to just asking rich people for $10,000 or $15,000 donations. So we think that could be helpful. But I don't see a political climate at the state level where that can happen unless there's more local action or these scandals, any of them which might actually hit in an area which raises the possibility of a voluntary system of public financing being a solution to one of the corruption problems identified. We know that some of the cases are about individuals in government using government contracts to shake down contractors for contributions, in particular to the governor's reelection effort in 2018. Will the revelations that come out in those cases generate public appetite for a system of public financing or campaign finance reform is unclear. And then again, there's the difficulty of coming up with stuff that really works, given these U.S. Supreme Court decisions, which make that much more difficult.
We've been talking with Blair Horner, Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group. Blair, if people want to find out more about NYPIRG, best way to do that?
NYPIRG.org would be the easiest way to go. You can see at all the various projects we're working on. You can also follow us on Twitter. We have a Twitter feed on our website, so you can actually see the issues that we're highlighting.
This has been Mark Dunley with WOOC. And that was Blair Horner of NYPIRG. On Wednesday is the governor's State of the State address, and we will be having some coverage of that, including some of the people speaking today at the 29th annual People's State of the State.
Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome, Alyssa.
I'd like to take these last remaining minutes to introduce two WOOC newcomers. Here with us now are Saron Cunningham and Olivia Stalvey. Welcome, guys.
Hi, thank you.
Hi.
So what do each of you do here?
We're both learning how to sound engineer with Jonah Moberg.
And Saron, you've also hosted a couple of times, right?
Yeah, I have.
How and when did each of you find The Sanctuary and or WOOC?
Well, Jonah actually is a longtime friend of mine, and we were hanging out at Denny's at Christmas at like midnight.
Nice.
Because, you know, that's what 20-somethings do, and he was telling me about this great new job he has and, you know, how they're looking for volunteers to learn on the soundboard, and I was just naturally interested. I like the idea of independent media and media in general, so just kind of showed up one day.
Well, we're glad you did.
Oh, thank you.
And Saron, how about you? How did you find The Sanctuary for independent media and when?
A few years back, actually. My first time with The Sanctuary, I actually volunteered in their garden before the radio station. So when the radio station was actually being built, I volunteered to help them, and then I guess I ended up here, and I hosted a few times, and I really like it.
Well, we're happy to have you here.
Thank you.
So what are some of the things about radio that most excite you and bring you here to the station?
Well, the thing that excites me most about radio is that you can get the most, you can spread your message in a different platform, and you can get the most listeners. But you don't know exactly who's listening. So that's the thing that's most exciting to me, because you might catch someone's ear who might be a billionaire or just a great activist, and they might come to the sanctuary. You get a whole bunch of different people here.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's a platform that's really available to anybody, you know, millionaires and non-millionaires. And it's also just a really diverse environment. You find and, you know, all media environments, lots of crazy, weird people and with cool ideas. And you can, you know, just the ability to share them freely and openly is really, really neat in this age, I think.
So, Saron, you said that you started coming here a long time ago, before the radio station even existed. How old were you when you do you remember how old you were when you first found yourself at the sanctuary?
Yeah, I think I was about 17.
And what brought you here in the first place? You said you were in the garden. Was that you were walking by and you saw some folks working outside and wanted to get involved?
Yeah, I was just walking by and I seen one of the members of the sanctuary. She was just working in the garden all by herself, and I wanted to be a helping hand, so I asked her if I could help. And then through that, me helping her every day in the garden, came along that this was actually associated with the sanctuary. And then just naturally, I was introduced to people from the sanctuary, and then it led into a radio station. And that was what brought me here today.
And how old are you now?
I'm 24.
Wow. So that was 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow. Just for the listeners who don't already know, the sanctuary is in North Troy. And one of the initiatives that we have besides the radio station is some urban gardens here by the name of Collard City Growers. And they are metaphorically blooming at this point of year up and down our block on 6th Avenue.
So if there are people out there going, that sounds kind of interesting, I'm not sure it's really for me, what would you say to get people to stop by and get involved?
Well, first off, learning how to grow in your own backyard is a great tool that I feel like everyone across the board should learn how to grow, because it's a good survival technique. Plus, just knowing how to use the land beneath your feet is a great benefit. Besides that, it's a great way to give back to your community in the public gardens. If you don't have anything else to do, you can always just go to a public garden and start your own little crop right there of anything that you would like to grow.
For me, I think volunteering is kind of necessary for a community to really exist. You need to have people working together, not just for money, for monetary reasons, but you need to volunteer to feel really connected, instead of just kind of existing next to each other. Why don't we all come together and do something and make something and see that turn into something else and pass that down? I think volunteering is very important.
Saron's clapping, and I'm also nodding my head vigorously. I do feel like that is a thread that many of the people who come to the sanctuary have in common, is a desire to serve and a feeling of purpose when serving. So, what about you, Mark?
Well, I appreciate the independent media aspect. I do a lot of activism work, and so much of the media today is owned by corporate interest and is very consolidated, and there's fewer and fewer news departments at radio stations and fewer reporters at the newspapers, and there needs to be a way to get out what people are doing. And I, of course, like the activism work, but it's also important just to get out what's going on in the community and build that sense of community. And that's why, to me, community radio is so important.
Thank you. Yeah, I certainly enjoy being here, in part because of great people like you guys. So thank you, Saron and Olivia, for joining us. And
thank you.
We look forward to seeing more of you.
Thank you.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Melissa Bromley.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Remember to tune back in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also listen through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
And on SoundCloud. WOOC 105.3 FM is brought to you by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering at the radio station, being a part of this effort. You can shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org, or you can just stop by one of our weekly meetings held on almost every Monday, except this week, which was the first of the year, at 7.07 p.m. right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.